It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
You are the only person in the world with whom I can commune on this subject, for you are the only person whose feelings can have any community with mine. You knew those we loved. With you, therefore, it will be no weakness to feel their loss. The man who has been deemed worthy of the heart of Theodosia Burr, and who has felt what it was to be blessed with such a woman's, will never forget his elevation. Joseph Alston, February 1813. Two 200 years ago, in the second decade of the 19th century, the world was a strange, fascinating, and precarious place. It was a time of global conflict and uneasy peace. A time of great environmental change. A time of disaster and miracles, anomalies and mysteries. It was a time when our modern world began to emerge, and a time like almost no other in history. This podcast is about stories, true stories, of this remarkable era. This is the Second Decade Podcast. My name is Sean Munger. I'm a historian, an author, teacher, and podcaster. You can visit the website for this podcast at seconddecade.net. Second Decade is spelled out, all one word, two D's in the middle. Thanks for joining me on this journey into the past. Episode 8, Theodosia. On the surface, this episode is the story of an unsolved mystery. On New Year's Eve 1812, a woman boarded a sailing ship called the Patriot in Georgetown, South Carolina, for a trip up the eastern coast to New York City. Neither she nor anyone else aboard the Patriot was ever seen alive again. They vanished, and no bodies were found. 57 years later, in 1869, a mysterious painting of an unidentified woman appeared in Nag's Head, North Carolina. The painting had a number of legends attached to it, but the one that was consistently told was that the woman in the portrait, a very beautiful woman in her late 20s with proud features and dark curly hair, was Theodosia Burr Alston, the woman who had vanished aboard the Patriot in the days just after New Year's, 1813. Theodosia Burr Alston was, at the time of her disappearance, not only the first lady of the state of South Carolina, but also the daughter of Aaron Burr, former Vice President of the United States, revolutionary, lawyer, scoundrel, and the murderer of Alexander Hamilton. The mystery involves two questions. What happened to the Patriot, her crew, and her passengers? And is the woman in the Nag's Head portrait really Theodosia Burr Alston? In this episode of Second Decade, I'll try to answer those two questions. But in doing so, we have to do more than just unravel two linked mysteries that have endured for more than 200 years. Tracing this remarkable woman and her final journey means getting to the very heart of who she was, who her father was, and why this father-daughter team was one of the most extraordinary power couples of the early 19th century. Prepare to meet the amazing and mysterious Theodosia. If you know anything about American history, as I know that many of my fans on this podcast do, you'll probably have some kind of reaction when I say the name Aaron Burr. He wasn't a general or a president like George Washington, or one of the great intellectual founders of the Revolution, like John Adams or James Madison. Indeed, Burr was kind of a gadfly of the early Republic, almost its Donald Trump. A recent biography of Burr, published by historian Nancy Eisenberg in 2007, I know Dr. Eisenberg, she's a wonderful historian, is called Fallen Founder, and that title perfectly sums up what we Americans generally think about Aaron Burr. If people like Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson are heroes of the American founding story, Aaron Burr is definitely the villain. Although he had a very eventful life with a lot of twists and turns, as well as political and personal accomplishments, Aaron Burr is most famous for committing murder. On July 11, 1804, in Weehawken, New Jersey, Burr met his political and personal rival, Alexander Hamilton, who had written some nasty things about him, and they engaged in a duel. Exactly what happened on that summer morning, who fired first, whose gun was rigged, all that sort of thing, that's been debated and rehashed for over 200 years. Suffice it to say, Hamilton was dragged back to New York, gushing blood from a hole in his hip. He croaked the next day. Burr, who was then Vice President of the United States, fled to Georgia, and eventually to Europe. He was indicted for murder, but never arrested or prosecuted. This is what most people know about Aaron Burr. Like most other things in history, the real story is a lot more complex. But this famous story is only a backdrop to the story I want to tell in this episode. Our main story is that of a truly amazing and fascinating woman. If they say that behind every great man is a woman, the woman behind Aaron Burr was undoubtedly Theodosia. But let's not get confused. There were actually two Theodosias in Aaron Burr's life. Let's start with the first one, Theodosia Bartow, the woman who would eventually marry Aaron Burr, and whose daughter, Theodosia Burr Alston, is the main subject of our story. Theodosia Bartow was born in New Jersey in 1746, the daughter of a prosperous lawyer. The elder Theodosia's father died before she was born, and her mother eventually married a British Army captain. This was in the 1750s, before the American Revolution. The British Army captain was very progressive. He insisted that Theodosia be brought up with the best education available to girls in the American colonies. This was a time when it was thought proper that girls should not be formally educated. Theodosia, again we're talking about the mother, Mrs. Aaron Burr, she learned to speak and write French, studied the classics, and eventually became an outspoken feminist. At age 17, she herself married a British Army officer, Jacques Marcus Prevost, whose family was heavily involved in colonial administration. Then the Revolution came. Unlike the rest of her family, Theodosia sided politically with the Patriots, the colonists who favored casting off British rule. At her estate in Bergen County, New Jersey, called the Hermitage, seems like everybody in the early Republic had an estate called the Hermitage, she entertained a lot of Patriot officers. One of them was George Washington, who briefly used the Hermitage as his headquarters. Another Patriot officer who wound up boozing at Theodosia Prevost's pad was a shrimpy little officer aged 21 named Aaron Burr. He was an interesting fellow. Already a seasoned war veteran, and supposedly his health was already ruined after being on an ill-fated military expedition to Quebec in 1775. Burr was well-educated, charming, and very smart. He was 10 years younger than Theodosia Prevost. Eventually, the two of them became lovers. In 1781, after Theodosia Prevost had been polishing Aaron Burr's knob for quite some time, she found out that her husband, the British Army officer, had conveniently died in the West Indies, some horrible fever. Even more conveniently, the Revolutionary War was winding down, and Aaron Burr found work as a lawyer in New York. He and the newly widowed Theodosia Prevost got married in 1782. She got preggers pretty quick. The Burr's daughter was born June 21, 1783, in Albany, New York, and they named her Theodosia after her mother. Theodosia Burr, the daughter, I mean, had one of the most fascinating and progressive childhoods in all of early America. Not only was her mother well-educated, an outspoken feminist, and a driving force behind Aaron Burr's private and political success in those early years of the 1780s, but Aaron Burr himself shared all these opinions, and he was determined to bring up his daughter as a smart, independent, liberated, and progressive young woman. As a young girl, Theodosia was brought up speaking and reading four languages, English, French, Latin, and Greek. She could sing, she could dance, she could read and interpret classical literature. She was encouraged to write letters to her father, who was often away on legal or political business, and he'd send back critiques of her letters. Aaron Burr and his wife were determined to bring up a daughter who was educated, who understood politics and history and philosophy, and most importantly, who could think for herself. These were radical ideas in the 1780s, 1790s. America had been founded on the principle, written down by Thomas Jefferson, that all men are created equal. But the Declaration of Independence says nothing about women. Nevertheless, one of the writers that young Theodosia Burr studied, Mary Wollstonecraft, specifically interpreted the ideals and ideology of the American and French revolutions to provide for the political and social independence of women. Feminism in the late 18th and early 19th century was a very powerful force, and smart people like Aaron Burr realized that the natural outgrowth of revolutionary ideals, as practiced in America and eventually in France, was that women were the political and social equals of men. Incidentally, Mary Wollstonecraft, the outspoken feminist of this period, was the mother of writer Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, who wrote the novel Frankenstein during the second decade, a subject that I'm going to cover in a future episode. Anyway, back to Theodosia. Aaron Burr, her father, was a successful lawyer in New York City. The family lived in a house on what's now Wall Street. I stayed at a hotel last summer that was probably less than 2 blocks from where Theodosia lived. Ironically, Alexander Hamilton, the man Theodosia's father murdered in 1804, is buried within that 2-block radius. Strange how these things converge in history. During the decade of the 1790s, the political consensus that gave rise to the founding of the United States as a nation started to fracture. Factions within the new government started to crystallize into political parties. One political party, the Federalists, epitomized by John Adams, started to rise, opposed by the Democratic Republicans, which championed Jefferson as their main guy. Aaron Burr was the Democratic Republican Party boss for New York City, one of the most important political territories in America in the 1790s. At about this same time, Burr's wife, the elder Theodosia, started to decline. She'd always been pretty frail in health, but about 1792 she took a downturn. The symptoms we can detect today seem to indicate that she had stomach cancer, a particularly agonizing way to die. On May 28, 1794, Theodosia Bartow Prevost Burr died, age 47. The death of his wife had the effect of drawing Aaron Burr much closer to his daughter. She was only 11, but already he began grooming her to be his social hostess, his public face, and his confidant. The letters between them took on a very intimate quality. He was very concerned with her appearance, her social manners, and her mental state. Here's a pretty telling example. In September 1795, while he was serving as senator from New York, this is what he wrote Theodosia in a letter. Quote, "Your habit of stooping and bringing your shoulders forward onto your breast not only disfigures you, but it's alarming on account of the injury to your health. The continuance in this vile habit will certainly produce a consumption. Then farewell, Papa, farewell, pleasure, farewell, life. This is no exaggeration, no fiction to excite your apprehensions. But setting aside this distressing consideration, I am astonished that you have no more pride in your appearance. You will certainly stint your growth and disfigure your person." End quote. Theodosia shaped up. By 1800, at age 17, she was the mistress and social hostess of Burr's estate at Richmond Hill in Manhattan. She came into the acquaintance of a wealthy South Carolina planter, Joseph Alston, who was also a sometime lawyer and sort of flitted on the edge of politics. In December 1800, just as the confused results of the presidential election that year were thrusting her father within a hair's breadth of the White House, Theodosia received a marriage proposal from Alston. Given her classical education, supposedly she read 200 lines of ancient Greek texts every day, she told Alston that Aristotle had said a man shouldn't marry until he was 36. He was 21. There was a long and involved exchange of letters, and eventually she agreed to marry him. It's been suggested that there might have been ulterior motives behind the marriage, specifically that Aaron Burr arranged it, or at least heavily lobbied in favor of it. Why? Well, money. Even at the height of his political career, Aaron Burr was always one bad debt away from losing Richmond Hill. An alliance with a wealthy southern family might bring some money into the family, as well as political contacts. There's no way to know for sure what the motives were. Theodosia Burr did marry Joseph Alston in Albany, New York, on February 2, 1801. Supposedly, they were the first married couple to honeymoon at Niagara Falls. Evidently, there were cheap motels and heart-shaped tubs even then. I'm kidding. February 1801 was a big month for the Burr family. Not only did Theodosia get married, but the climactic vote took place in the U.S. House of Representatives to determine who was going to be the third president of the United States. How Aaron Burr ended up within one electoral vote of being president is a really long and complicated story. It's beyond the scope of this show, but perhaps one of my fellow history podcasters could do a show on it. Suffice it to say, Burr and Thomas Jefferson, both of whom were from the same political party, each received 73 electoral votes. This was a mistake by state legislatures and the political machinery, especially in New York, which Burr controlled. From February 11th to February 17th, 1801, the House of Representatives took ballot after ballot, 35 total, all of which were deadlocked. Neither Jefferson nor Burr got an absolute majority. It fell to Alexander Hamilton, a Federalist who hated both of them, to broker a deal. He was put in the unenviable position of deciding which of these guys he hated least. Ultimately, he decided to give Burr the shaft. Through Hamilton's influence, Federalist representatives swung the vote to Jefferson on the 36th ballot. He got elected. Under the Constitution at that time, later fixed by the 12th Amendment, Burr became vice president, but he had very little to do in that office. In the winter of 1802, Theodosia, now Mrs. Joseph Alston, gave birth to a son. They named him Aaron Burr Alston, after his grandfather. The birth left her in delicate health. The next couple of years were spent in search of cures, which in the early 19th century meant going to a spa and swimming in mineral water and smearing mud on yourself or, you know, something like that. A lot of these kinds of spas were located in upstate New York, where Theodosia was comfortable. Theodosia had no involvement in the famous duel that changed her father's fortunes. In the historical novel Burr by Gore Vidal, one of the key plot points is that the duel is supposedly triggered by Hamilton suggesting that there was an incestuous relationship between Aaron Burr and his daughter, and this is the true cause of Burr's challenge. This is fiction. There's no evidence, at least none that I'm aware of, that this is true. In 1806, as her father was on the run, I use that term kind of loosely, as he was on the run after the duel, Theodosia and her son Aaron Jr. accompanied Aaron Burr to Ohio to visit a friend of his, an English-Irish adventurer and politician named Harmon Blennerhassett. Blennerhassett had a lavish European-style estate built on an island in the Ohio River. Exactly what happened on Blennerhassett's island in the spring and summer of 1806 remains unclear even more than 200 years later. The administration of Thomas Jefferson, who prosecuted Burr for treason in 1807, insists that it was a plot to break off the West from the United States and establish it as a separate country, which Burr would supposedly rule. If that happened, Theodosia Alston might have been the princess of, I don't know, Beringia? Sounds kind of far-fetched, doesn't it? The true purpose of the plot, which involves some military officers and stockpiled guns, might have been to take over Texas, which was then ruled by Spain. Again, another long, complicated subject we don't have time to go into. Long story short, the plot, whatever it was, failed. Blennerhassett's Island was overrun by Virginia militia, the house eventually burnt down, and Aaron Burr, acquitted of treason, which is a pretty flimsy charge, he eventually went to Europe. Theodosia, then living in South Carolina, acted as her father's agent, so to speak, while he was in exile in Europe. She continued to correspond with him, raised money for him, and took charge of his diaries and papers. Always there was a vague sense that Aaron Burr would eventually return to the U.S. when things died down. He kept trying in various countries to get a passport to return to the U.S. In February 1811, Theodosia wrote from Oaks, South Carolina, "Your letter of the 10th of November last is just received. The difficulty you find in procuring a passport excites many unpleasant feelings. Will not any of your old friends assist you? Pray return as soon as possible. In dear New York, you have many friends, and in Connecticut, I believe, a majority of the citizens are attached to you, a greater proportion than in any other state of the Union." End quote. In the summer of 1812, Burr finally got a passport and arranged passage home. By this time, things were getting complicated. Jefferson, Burr's big political enemy, was out of office. But the U.S. had just declared war on Great Britain, and shipping between the states and Europe was bound to be disrupted. Burr hurried home aboard a ship called the Aurora, traveling under the name DiGamelli. Supposedly, when he arrived in Boston, he wore a wig and a fake beard to avoid being recognized. He was pretty much penniless when he arrived on American shores, so poor, in fact, he couldn't even pay for passage to New York, where most of his political allies were. He pawned a trunk full of books he'd brought from Europe to the president of Harvard College, who gave him $40 for them, enough to get back to New York. His idea was to get there, look around, make sure his creditors weren't scoping for him, and if the coast was clear, quietly resume his law practice. Of course, he wanted Theodosia to join him and help him set up. Burr had letters delivered to her in South Carolina, urging her to come up to New York. On July 12, 1812, Theodosia finally wrote back to her father. She said, "A few miserable days passed, my dear father, and your late letters would have gladdened my soul. And even now I rejoice at their contents as much as it is possible for me to rejoice at anything. I have lost my boy. My child is gone forever. He expired on the 30th of June. My head is not now sufficiently collected to say anything further." Theodosia's son, the namesake of Aaron Burr, had died of a fever. Theodosia took to her bed, deathly ill from grief. There was no way she could go to New York or anywhere until she got significantly better. In the meantime, due to political disruptions related to the war, the South Carolina state legislature elected Theodosia's husband, Joseph Alston, to be governor of South Carolina. He took office on December 10, 1812, amidst fears of a British invasion. By December, Theodosia was a little better, at least well enough to travel. The plan was still for her to go to New York, but her husband's military duties as head of the South Carolina militia meant he could not accompany her, and it was thought that someone should. Aaron Burr sent one of his friends, Timothy Green, down from New York to South Carolina to bring her back by ship. It was Green, therefore, that booked passage for the two of them to New York, aboard the schooner Patriot, which had previously been a privateer. On December 31, 1812, Theodosia Burr Alston and Timothy Green went aboard the Patriot at its dock in Georgetown, South Carolina. It was the beginning of a fateful voyage and an enduring mystery. So what happened to the Patriot and Theodosia Burr Alston? Here's what we know, or at least what has been asserted as true, with some reasonable historical evidence to support it. The Patriot, with Theodosia on board, sailed from Georgetown, South Carolina, on New Year's Eve, 1812. It was under the command of one Captain Overstock's, great name. The voyage was to take 5 or 6 days. The Patriot was known as an especially fast ship. Of course, this being wartime, the British Navy had a blockade around the American coasts. Theodosia carried a written message aboard from her husband, Governor Alston of South Carolina, requesting that the Patriot be allowed through the blockade. They were on a humanitarian mission delivering a sick woman to her father in New York. The British evidently bought it. They intercepted the Patriot, possibly on New Year's Day, and allowed the ship to sail through the blockade. This was the last time the Patriot was ever seen. On January 2, 1813, a ferocious gale came up and struck the Carolina coast. The occurrence of the storm in conjunction with the disappearance of the Patriot leads to the obvious conclusion. The ship sank in the storm with all hands aboard, including Theodosia Burr Alston. Supposedly, this is not gospel truth, but it's a story that's been circulated. Sometime during the month of January 1813, the body of an unidentified woman washed up on the shore of Cape Charles, Virginia. She was dressed in very fine clothes. Since no one could identify her, she was buried on a farm not far away. Supposedly, her grave is still there. This could, I stress could, have been the body of Theodosia. What's undoubtedly true is that the Patriot never docked in New York. On January 15, 1813, Governor Joseph Alston wrote to his wife. He said, quote, "Another mail and still no letter. I hear two rumors of a gale off Cape Hatteras the beginning of the month. The state of my mind is dreadful. Let no man, wretched as he may be, presume to think himself beyond the reach of another blow. All my prayers are for your safety and well-being." 4 days later, still hearing nothing, Alston wrote to Theodosia's father, Aaron Burr. He said, "Tomorrow will be 3 weeks since, in obedience to your wishes, Theodosia left me. It is 3 weeks, and yet not one line from her. My mind is tortured." Before Alston could finish this letter, evidently he received a mail delivery which contained a letter from Aaron Burr, asking Alston where Theodosia was. "You ask me to relieve your suspense," Alston wrote. "Alas, it was to you I looked for similar relief." By now, both men were aware that something was terribly wrong. On February 25, 1813, after another exchange of letters and a bunch of inquiries, principally about the big New Year's gale, Alston again wrote to his father-in-law. There was no more hope. Theodosia was gone. In the space of little more than 6 months, Joseph Alston lost his 10-year-old son and his wife. Aaron Burr had lost, for the second time, the woman he was then closest to in the world. Neither of them were ever the same again. This is all we can know for sure about the fate of Aaron Burr's daughter. Where historical fact leaves off, folklore takes over. There's a lot of folklore, legends, and outright lies associated with the fate of Theodosia. We're now going to get into some of those stories, and one in particular, which at least one historian believed he'd proven to be true. Maybe. You be the judge. In 1902, a man in Detroit, Michigan, calling himself Charles Henry Burr Crosby, who said he was 108 years old, gave an interview to a local paper. He insisted that he was the illegitimate son of Aaron Burr, born in 1794, and that his mother was a mixed-race woman of Indian and African-American blood. Supposedly, he was born in England, where Burr sent his mother for her own safety. Conveniently, Crosby was in the U.S. in 1813, so he said, and signed up as a cook aboard a ship called the Independence, which picked up two shipwrecked men on a raft. Supposedly, Crosby overheard these men talking, and they revealed that they were pirates, who'd captured the Patriot at sea and forced Theodosia to walk the plank. Crosby told the captain, who arrested the pirates, brought them to New York, and they were prosecuted for murder by none other than Aaron Burr, who knew they'd killed his daughter, but carefully kept her name out of the record of the trial. This story is utter garbage. Nothing about it makes sense. Burr did have illegitimate children, but Charles Henry Crosby was not one of them. The details of this guy's story of his own life were inconsistent and contradictory. The pirates he names, Gibbs and Wansley, did exist, but they were active many years later. And how could Aaron Burr, prosecuting the pirates who killed his daughter, possibly kept her name out of official records or the papers? Incidentally, Burr was not a public prosecutor. He was a private lawyer. He did reasonably well with his law practice after 1812. He died in 1836. The second tale, which is also complete crap, goes like this. Supposedly, Theodosia secretly got off the Patriot before the gale, evidently in Alexandria, Virginia, with a mysterious man rumored to be her lover, or possibly her husband, even though the historical record shows that she was already married to Joseph Alston. The woman, seen by various people in Alexandria, is naturally described as a creature of rare beauty. She was ill at the time she arrived, and her husband called a doctor to the inn where they were staying. The mysterious unnamed husband stuck a gun in the doctor's face and said, cure her as best you can, but if you ask her a single question about who she is, I'll blow your head off. The doctor couldn't save her, the woman died, and the husband quickly arranged her anonymous burial in a churchyard in Alexandria. The grave this story is associated with is still there. The inscription reads, "To the memory of a female stranger whose mortal sufferings terminated on the 14th day of October, 1816, aged 23 years and 8 months. The stone is placed here by her disconsolate husband, in whose arms she sighed her last breath, and who, under God, did his utmost to soothe the cold, dread fear of death." The female stranger is said, in local folklore, to have been Theodosia Burr. but this story is obviously what we now call fake news. The dates are wrong. Theodosia died in 1813, not 1816. She was 29 years old, not 23. And the idea that she would run off and marry some random stranger while she was still married to one of the richest men in South Carolina is pretty stupid. In fact, this story didn't even begin circulating, evidently, until the 1830s. It was probably made up to explain the anonymous grave at the Alexandria Churchyard, which is still a tourist attraction. A lot of 19th century urban legends suffer from obvious flaws like this. It was a lot easier to get away with this kind of crap before Google, or at least Snopes.com. We can be certain that Theodosia Burr is not buried at St. Paul's Episcopal Cemetery in Alexandria, Virginia. Here is the story that at least one historian believes is corroborated by evidence. I have my doubts about this one too, but it's worth talking about. In the late 1940s, shortly after World War II, a New England armchair historian and adventurer named Edward Rowe Snow, who wrote a lot of books on Atlantic maritime history, arrived in Nag's Head, North Carolina, determined to solve the mystery of what happened to Theodosia. Edward Rowe Snow was a fascinating guy. He wrote over 40 books and numerous articles on maritime and coastal history, collecting stories and tall tales, investigating some, throwing some out there as is, a lot of them about pirates or other colorful subjects. He hosted a radio show and wrote a newspaper column. He taught school in Massachusetts and had a loyal following of history buffs. I absolutely love the works of Edward Rowe Snow, though I don't take all of them or even a lot of them as gospel truth, and you shouldn't either. Anyway, based on his research conducted in the 1940s, here's what Snow thought happened. He focused on a pirate named Dominique Yu, Y-O-U, or sometimes spelled Y-O-U-X, who was the second mate for Jean Lafitte, the famous Mississippi River pirate who operated around New Orleans during the second decade. I used to live in New Orleans. I went to law school there. I used to go for drinks at a famous bar called Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop, built in 1722, which is associated with Jean Lafitte the pirate. I'm quite sure Jean Lafitte will appear again in this podcast series. Anyway, according to Edward Rowe Snow, Dominique Yu, in command of his own coastal pirate ship, spotted the Patriot on the morning of January 3, 1813. She had been damaged by the gale the night before, adrift and dismasted, but still afloat. He and his pirate crew boarded and took over the boat. They shot the men, including Timothy Green and the captain, and they found Theodosia hiding in her cabin. The pirates brought Theodosia on deck and interrogated her. She told them who she was. One of the pirates moved forward to rape her, but Yu, the pirate captain, stopped him. Rowe records that he said these words, "Now you know that she must die. Death is the bond I signed, but never rape." Knowing she was going to die, the pirates weren't going to leave any living witnesses to convict them, Theodosia decided that they don't wait, just get it over with. She willingly walked the plank and jumped into the ocean. The pirates then ransacked the ship for plunder. In Theodosia's cabin, they found a trunk full of fine dresses and a beautiful oil painting, the portrait of the woman they had just executed. They were planning to haul away all the loot and burn the Patriot. Before they could finish, though, they saw a sail on the horizon. Not wanting another ship to be attracted by the sight of smoke on the horizon, the pirates quickly evacuated and left the loot behind that they hadn't yet been able to offload. This included the dresses and the oil painting. A day later, the Patriot, still floating, drifted toward Nag's Head, North Carolina. A group of coastal scavengers known as the Wreckers sailed out and boarded her, finding the ship deserted and slowly sinking. One of these Wreckers, a fellow named Mann, took the chest of dresses and the oil painting ashore and gave them to his sweetheart. The Patriot sank in a few hours and was gone forever. Edward Rowe Snow asserted that this account was corroborated. On the bottom of page 300 of his book, Strange Tales from Nova Scotia to Cape Hatteras, published in 1949, he writes this in a footnote. "A surprising corroboration of my findings is a sworn statement made February 14, 1903, by Mrs. Harriet Sprague before Notary Freeman Atwell at Cass County, Michigan, of the confession in 1848 of Frank Burdick, who admitted that he was one of the pirates who murdered Theodosia Burr in 1813. The story agrees essentially with my account." So what do I think of this exciting and romantic story of the gallant death of Theodosia Burr Alston? Survey says, crap. Edward Rowe Snow was a great guy and a thrilling writer, but in this case he fell for a hoax. The tale of Dominique Yu and his pirates coming across the Patriot and executing Theodosia Burr comes from a novel, yes, a fictional novel, called Fernando de Lemos, Truth in Fiction, published in 1872, written by a fellow named Charles Gayarre, a colorful pseudo-historian from New Orleans. The 1903 affidavit is a sworn statement of someone else's supposed deathbed confession, recorded 55 years after the confession itself and 90 years after the events it described. I don't think we can give it any credence. Dominique Yu and the pirates associated with Jean Lafitte stuck mostly to river traffic in the New Orleans area and the Gulf of Mexico. To my knowledge, there's no evidence that they operated off the coast of the Carolinas. That would have been hard to do in any event, given the British blockade. Besides, doesn't it seem a little thick that the Patriot just happens to survive this epic gale, and a famous pirate just happens to come across the wrecked and still floating ship, and that he just happens to be honorable enough, if you can call it that, to murder this lady in cold blood, but letting his men commit rape is a bridge too far? 19th century urban legends often have this kind of romantic angle to them. This is crap. I'm sorry, this story is just crap. So we've had three stories now about the possible fate of Theodosia, and all three have turned out to be big steaming turds. So what did happen to her and the others aboard the Patriot? I think the simplest answer is probably the correct one, and the conclusion that Aaron Burr and Joseph Alston came to in their letters in January and February 1813. The Patriot wrecked in the gale and went down with all hands. However, though he probably got Theodosia's fate wrong, Edward Rowe Snow is still useful to us. On that trip to Nag's Head in the 1940s, he did some apparently genuine, though still not conclusive, detective work on the other mystery surrounding Theodosia's disappearance, that being the famous portrait said to be of her that mysteriously surfaced at Nag's Head in 1869. What happened was this. In 1869, a doctor from Elizabeth City, North Carolina, named William Poole, was on vacation at Nag's Head when he was called to treat an elderly woman who lived in a shack near the beach. These shacks were left over from the early part of the century, including the second decade, when the people of this area, known as the Bankers, made their living plundering ships that wrecked on the sandbars near there. The Bankers built their shacks from pieces of wreckage that washed ashore. In fact, Nag's Head supposedly gets its name from the practices of the Bankers. They'd hang a lantern around a horse's neck and parade him up and down the beach, hoping that ships out at sea would assume it was the light of a ship at anchor, make for it, and then wreck on the sandbars. Then they'd go to work looting the wrecks and killing the crews. This is exactly the sort of colorful local history that Edward Rowe Snow loved to tell. Anyway, Dr. Poole treated the old woman in the Banker's shack, whose name is not entirely certain. Snow gives her name as Lovey Westcott. I found a blog online telling the same story, who gives the name as Amelia Mann. Given a choice between those two, I'm going to go with Snow, who actually did some investigation on site. The story goes that this shack was crude and falling apart, but Dr. Poole saw hanging on the wall this lovely Federal-era portrait of a rich young lady in a white dress. When he asked about it, Lovey Westcott told him that it had been given to her by a previous suitor, an ex-fiancé, more than 50 years before. He was one of the Bankers, and supposedly salvaged the painting from a ship that wrecked off Nag's Head during the War of 1812. Mrs. Westcott was poor and had no money to pay the doctor, so the story goes she gave the painting to Dr. Poole as payment for his services. Whether this story is true, the painting is definitely real, and it did somehow appear in Nag's Head in 1869. Art historians examined it and determined it was probably painted by New York painter John Vanderlyn, a protege of Aaron Burr, who had painted Theodosia's portrait before in 1802. Once the painting began to be exhibited in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, according to Snow, several members of the Alston-Burr clan saw it and exclaimed that it had to be Theodosia, though the only one who actually knew her in person could not positively identify it. It certainly does look like her. During the 20th century, the painting went through several owners and eventually wound up at the Lewis Walpole Library in Farmington, Connecticut. Though officially called the Nag's Head Portrait, the painting is generally believed to be of Theodosia Burr Alston. Whether it is or not, clearly it was painted during the 18-teens and shows a wealthy and cultured woman. I chose this painting and the image of the woman to include in the collage of images that make up the main header image for the Second Decade podcast. If you've listened to Second Decade before, whether on your phone, on iTunes, online, or if you've seen me promoted on my Twitter or on my blog, then you've definitely seen the Nag's Head Portrait. It's the young woman to the right of the image, opposite Thomas Jefferson. Edward Rowe Snow, when he visited Nag's Head in the 1940s investigating the case of Theodosia Burr, he met a man there named Nevin Westcott, who worked for the Coast Guard station there. His father also worked for the Coast Guard. When Snow asked about the portrait, Westcott told him to look up his father, John Westcott. According to Edward Rowe Snow, when he met and interviewed John Westcott at his home, this was what he said. "Well, Mr. Snow, you've come to the right place. My own grandmother was the woman who gave Dr. Poole the painting. Her name was Lovey Tillett when she got the painting. One of the young wreckers down the beach was mad about her and gave her the dresses and the painting which he'd taken from the pilot boat. But it didn't do him any good. She married John Westcott later on, who, of course, was my grandfather." I certainly don't credit Snow with having solved the mystery of what happened to Theodosia, as he triumphantly claims on page 304 of Strange Tales from Nova Scotia to Cape Hatteras. However, I do believe this part of the story about the provenance of the painting, and I do believe the Nag's Head portrait is of Theodosia Burr Alston. So what did happen? Well, here's my theory. I can't prove it, but this is my take on what happened. January 2, 1813. The gale around Cape Hatteras seriously damages the Patriot, probably dismasting her, somewhere out at sea. Maybe some of the crew were killed, the ship was probably sinking, and possibly the survivors, including Theodosia, decide to abandon ship. They get in a boat and cast off. In the ferocious gale, they don't have much of a chance, and die pretty quickly. Contrary to their expectations, however, the ship remains afloat, at least partially. The wreckage drifts near the sandbars at Nag's Head, where the bankers operate. In the aftermath of the storm, the bankers, including Mann, see the ship from afar, row out and go aboard. It's deserted. They take what loot they can before the ship sinks, and they row ashore. Mann gives some of the booty, including the portrait, to his sweetheart, the future Lovey Westcott. There it remains in a banker shack near the beach, ready to be discovered in 1869. That's my version. In spinning our elaborate theories about shipwrecks and lost paintings, let's not lose sight of the real focus of this story. A real-life woman, extraordinary and fascinating, named Theodosia Burr Alston, one of the most remarkable characters you'll meet in the Second Decade. If you like this podcast, please share it, tell somebody about it, mention it on your social media, your Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, whatever is your thing. I'd love for you to contribute to my Patreon account, that's patreon.com/SeanMunger. Pledge an amount, even a dollar, and get access to members-only goodies that no one gets, including video bonus lectures. In addition to my Patreon account, you can find me on Twitter at SeanMunger, there's an underscore there, and on my website, SeanMunger.com. My historical sources for this episode include correspondence of Aaron Burr and his daughter Theodosia, edited and with a preface by Mark Van Doren, Stratford Press, 1929, and Strange Tales from Nova Scotia to Cape Hatteras by Edward Rowe Snow, Dodd, Mead & Company, New York, 1949. Music credits. The main theme of this podcast is titled String Impromptu No. 1 by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, used under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license. This podcast was written and recorded by me, Sean Munger. Good night.